Dialogue on Teaching. I am Nancy Lynn Westfield, Director of the Wabash Center, and in our engineer's booth is Dr. Paul Myrie. It is my great pleasure to have as our guest Dr. Ralph Jacobson. Ralph is Professor of Old Testament, as well as the Alvin N. Rodness Chair of Scripture, Theology, and Ministry at Luther Seminary. Welcome, Ralph, to the conversation.
It is great to be here. I come to you live from the galactic headquarters of the Dewald Jacobson family.
All of that. We want all of that. We want the family involved. Are you doing any homeschooling?
Yeah, I am. I have a daughter home from college who just, tonight actually is her last religion class in college with Dr. Elna Solvang, a Wabash loyalist from my first group at Wabash. And my son is in high school. And so I'm a math professor too. I should add that to my title.
You should.
Teaches trigonometry.
Oh, the CV will be weightier in that regard.
Exactly.
And you haven't been driven crazy by any of this?
No, but you know what? That is, I think, the number one reality that people are facing in their teaching. When we had our first Zoom faculty meeting, faculty meetings are already the place where good ideas go to die.
Right.
And so now it's worse because we're all on Zoom and everyone's got a microphone in front of their face so they think they can talk more. Mm-hmm. And one of my colleagues, a little bit younger, broke down crying in the faculty meeting. She said, just because the reality, right, she and her husband both doing full-time jobs and then two little kids at home, mm-hmm. that they're homeschooling. So at least my kids are a little older, mostly self-sufficient. But I say that as an example because that's where my students are. Suddenly, full-time students at home with, one of my students, five kids. Mm-hmm. And that is the number one stressor, I think, that is making learning really hard is just that sense of being overwhelmed, especially by students who have younger kids, or maybe they have a parent they're taking care of.
That's right.
In their house who might be at special risk for this illness. So those family realities just make, so some students are saying, I can't take it. I'm overwhelmed. Other students are like, I need this. I have to have order and routine in my life. So the students are coming at from different perspectives in response to the stress. Some of my single students, maybe that are sort of traditional, what we would think of normally as traditional age for seminary. So they've had to go back home and move in with their parents. And so they're the kid in the house. And so they can't find any part-time work to keep, car payments paid and things like that. And so they're in this weird place back in their teenage bedroom, back in a family system that maybe they don't really want to live in that family system, So there's all sorts of family stress. And I think that's the number one thing making learning difficult for students.
Well, another dimension that I'm sure you would agree with is that the two spouses or the two partners in the same household trying to work at the same time.
Well, yes.
Right? So kids, no kids, caring for elders, not caring for elders, all these dimensions. Another dimension is if both partners or all the partners are working, everybody is like no house is big enough for everybody to work when they need to work is one of the reports I've heard.
That's absolutely true. Our house is a modest house, and it was not built for four full-sized people, because even my 15-year-old is 6'4". So it wasn't built for four full-sized people to be all working from home. All the time. So we're fitting in this podcast right in the perfect window between when my wife and son ran to Target for supplies, and my daughter's downstairs in class. And I'm hoping that my contractor, who's got to arrive to fix the fence, I'm hoping he doesn't knock at the back door any second.
So let's continue talking about what is this doing? Not is it doing? What is this doing to student formation? right? So when we say as good pedagogues, as good teachers, that we are about forming students.
Right.
In this time of crisis, how do you get a handle on that?
Well, I think it's, I don't know how to get a handle on it, because that's, of course, the big mystery anyway, is how do you get a handle on formation? We kind of define formation as having different aspects at Luther Seminary. So it's not just intellectual, obviously. It's interpersonal. There's a maturity factor, a character factor, and, you know, you put all those together and that's formation. I would say that the great thing that's happening in formation is students they have to take their own agency for their own formation. We know that. At some point, that is, we can't do formation. Students have to integrate on their own. And since formation is by definition an integrative, I don't ever say that word right, but one must integrate intellectual, interpersonal, character, right? Skills. They're forced to do that because they're everyone's on their own. So I had a student last night. I kind of mentioned her already. She's got five kids, and she emailed me and said, "I don't want to take this one class this summer. Could there be an independent study on pastoring during a pandemic?" She wasn't kidding.
That's brilliant.
And I said, "Yeah, let's do it."
Yeah.
I have no idea how I'm going to teach that, I didn't even know what we're going to read together. But so she's doing that, right? And so I think that's an example of students are saying, "This is what I need at this point, and I'm going to go find it. I'm going to go do it." So yeah, any emails later, like read this, right? Read that. I'd be up for any tips you guys have.
But credit to you, and of course this is why we're talking to Dr. Ralph Jacobson. Credit to you for hearing that, not as a lighthearted throwaway comment, but saying yes to creating an independent study on pastoring during the pandemic, right? So another ear would have said, "No, we can't do that because I don't know the literature." Can't do that because it's too raw, it's too present. No, you know, there's a thousand reasons to say no to that. And you, Ralph, said, "Yeah, let's give that a try."
Yeah, well, thank you, Lynn. I appreciate that. I think I probably learned that from you. But how to listen to that kind of thing. I think that that's one of the things is to get by is give yourself permission to say yes, or better yet, say yes, give yourself permission to give permission as much as possible. This is not a time to operate out of a regulatory structure of decision making, right? Which is, well, let me go and look in the handbook, the course catalog, and see if we have that class.
But the faculty handbook.
Yeah.
Just in the faculty handbook. It's not in the faculty
handbook. It's not in the faculty handbook. Because most faculty, it will be, right?
Like 5 or 6 years after the committees meet.
Like most of the laws, right. Because most of the laws, like in the Pentateuch of the Bible, are about how to keep the last cow from escaping again, right? You know what I mean? Something happens, you go, "Okay, we got to make a law that doesn't allow that to happen." There's that law about you must put a parapet, which is a fancy word for fence, on top of your flat house, lest someone fall off, right?
Somebody's cousin fell off.
One of my contemporaries, who's a pastor of a pretty big church in Chicago area, I mean, he messaged me last week to say, and these are two famous professors from our background. He goes, "Now, was it Ferdy or was it Nestegen who taught the class on how to be a pastor in a pandemic?" Right? And saying, basically, I'm out here and we weren't taught how to do this. Mm-hmm. And that's another, I mean, that's a fun thing to do, is to collect. The old director of ATS, whose name, because I'm 54, escapes me at the moment, he said that all graduate schools, professional graduate schools, seminaries, med schools, you know, are houses of best practice. But what we do is we curate best practices from those in the field who have invented them, and then we pass them on to the next generation. He said, we don't know what the best practices are anymore.
For the current, right? Because the
well,
current...
He said this 10 years ago.
Yeah. And but I understand this principle, right?
Yeah.
So I used to, in teaching my intro class, shift my class based on the previous year's encounters, grapplings, befuddlements. Right. And then I would improve it for the coming class. Now, you see the problem with that.
I do, actually.
The next group of students did not have those befuddlements, did not have those problems. They're not systemic problems. So it took a long time to train myself to stop shifting based on previous experience and live into the current moment.
Ah, but see, now you are doing advanced shape-shifting, right? Because you have to both do that and then, like you said, not do it, right?
Yep.
So how do we listen to the innovations in the field, mm-hmm, and at the same time not let one person's experience be over-determinative? One of the pastors I know, and I know a lot of pastors, is he's in a little town. It is a town that both city limit signs are nailed to the same post, you know, in Wisconsin. And he's been there a long time. He is the pastor of the town, as well as literally the mayor now. And so whenever something happens in that town, whether that person is technically a member of the church he serves or not, he gets drug in. Mm-hmm. So on Easter Sunday, we're Lutheran tradition. So how is he going to give communion, mm-hmm, on Easter when you can't gather? Mm-hmm. So they posted their, some pastors are buying these small FM transmitters that transmit like 500 yards, and they're doing church in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. But they did drive through communion. Mm-hmm. But how are you going to stay 6 feet apart? Well, they had canoe paddles. Now, you think I'm making this up because it's Lake Wobegon, but I'm not making it up. They put the communion on canoe paddles, yes, and stretched it out, and they had more people come through than they have members, mm-hmm, because all the Catholics and because the Catholic Church wasn't doing it, but the Catholics wanted communion. And then a bunch of other people he'd never seen. So, you know, it's people are doing stuff out there. And how do you make that not determinative, though? Right? Because they're not going to do canoe paddles. And
particularly after it's over with, you wonder, I mean, it'll be fascinating to see what practices people retain, maintain,
right,
whether they go back to what they used to do or not, right? What's gonna stick, what's gonna hold, what do we still need that we have innovated to kind of survive and get through this struggle will be fascinating.
Yeah, you know, so that's exactly right. What I've noticed is the people who want change and who are feeling constrained, and you know, that's just a type of person. Mm-hmm. They're like trying to use this crisis to say, okay, we're never going back to normal. Now we have to embrace the change. And then the people, and this is a type of person who don't want anything to change, are like, no, we must not change during this time. So
they want to conserve all that is.
Yes. So here you've been doing these. Here's my question for you. Mm. Have you gotten, one of the things that is happening is people are being, what's the word, fatigued by Zoom.
That's right.
I mean, so any tips so far about how to help people deal? I think a couple reasons people are fatigued by Zoom. One is the headphones. It just, if you have headphones on for any length of time,
it squeezes your brain.
It feels claustrophobic, mm-hmm. right? It squeezes your brain. But also then you're in front of a small screen.
And you have to keep still. One of the problems I have is literally staying in one spot in front of the camera, trying to be respectful of the people you're talking to. But in doing that, even in a meeting, I'm moving around more. Mm-hmm. In Zoom, I'm trying to stay literally in one spot, sometimes mm-hmm. for hours. So, I mean, how I deal with it is I only do Zoom 4 days a week. I will not do it more than 4 days a week. I only do as little Zoom as possible on any given day. Like if I have three Zoom calls or three Zoom meetings already on a day, I won't, unless it's something terrible or emergency, which everything is right now, put the fourth or the fifth one on the calendar on any given day. That my fantasy is still that when we work from home remotely, somehow I'll have more control over the work. The work has been overwhelming. It's been a tsunami of things to do and tend to and take care of, and doing it in the screen has just added another layer of frustration.
Right.
So it's a difficult time for many reasons.
Yeah. So in other words, there is no cure to Zoom fatigue.
I don't think so.
Other than to embrace it and then try to mitigate it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what has worked for me. And I'm not saying that is for everybody. But the other thing I do is if I'm just talking to one person, I'll call them on the phone and not Zoom them.
Yeah, I do that too now.
So you don't have to Zoom everything.
No, that's exactly right. One of the things I've noticed, I mean, I think most places probably have like lists of best practices for Zoom. One of which is to have like passwords so you don't get Zoom. Like in this meeting, I noticed you sent a password so you don't have somebody randomly bombing and taking over.
Yeah.
And there's unbelievable stories about locally about things that have happened to people. But one of the things I've noticed both colleagues and students doing is like taking their computer out under the deck. This is bad. It's a best practice to say don't allow your students to do that. It's distracting, the sound quality, then you get like all sorts of ambient other sounds that come in, and their home Wi-Fi probably gets a little bit iffy out in the deck. And
it's like the request every spring students would say, can we meet outside for class? No, we can't meet outside for class. Go outside after class. We're in class.
Exactly.
I'm not going to lecture to you under on a picnic table. I'm just not. We're not going to break into small group conversations at the picnic table. So I understand the impulse. No, the answer is no, we're not going to do that. So last question, go back to the student that had the agency.
Mm-hmm.
To ask for what she needed, or the curiosity to think about what she needed, or the, because I would be surprised if she wasn't integrating anything. She was articulating what she thought her curiosity would be or what her need would be. I don't think it's overstated for us as teachers to listen for that, but again, to have students think in those ways. The question of what do you need is so often met with, I don't know what I need, but how do you push past the I don't know to spend some time thinking, feeling, figuring out the need as a student?
Well, I think this I did learn from you, Lynn, which is ask for what you need. You might not get it, but if you don't ask, you're not getting it.
If you don't ask, you're not getting it. That's right.
And so that is one of my norms that I tell students. To have as part of a norm in teaching, ask for what you need, mm-hmm. Is the first part about giving people permission to not be, I guess I can only say it positively, give people permission to be their own agent.
Yeah.
And so that, I think that's the first thing in teaching is it helps if you give people that permission early and often. And it comes in many ways. I mean, the simplest way is, here's the final assignment. It's a paper. But hey, any project you want to think about, you know, you can propose. Any project you can propose, as long as it meets the learning outcomes, right? So that's like the first level, but it gets on and on. It goes on and on to the point where somebody would say, and this is the reason the student is in a totally cohort-based learning pathway that we have. So it goes 24 months and they get 8 terms in 24 months. And so their classes are scripted. They're told, here's the 4 classes you're taking this summer. That's why people, listeners might be going, why can't they just take a different class? Well, it's because they're told, here's your 4 classes. Mm-hmm. But one of the classes, she doesn't want to take for good reasons. And so to have the agency then to say, I don't want to take it, but here's what I would really like to do, right? And I think, like you said, it might have started off as a joke, but then you think, like a lot of jokes, you're like, there's a lot of truth there.
That's right. Well, and sometimes the asking is, you don't come with a full package of, this is what I'd like to do, here are my learning goals, here's the new project, all you're able to do is irp out something. And then our job is to talk to and be in conversation with and tease out and maybe even lay some of our experiences on, okay, let's attend to that ERP that you just had, that you just had, and maybe we can do something about it.
Yeah, and then I have to ask colleagues for help, you know, which I think is a good modeling. First of all, it's a good just to be able to do that, which is, I once had a student who's now herself a teacher in grad school, but somebody asked me a question in a Psalms class. That's my expertise. And I said, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. And the student came up afterwards and said, you said, I don't know, when somebody asked you a question. I said, she goes, why did you say that? I said, well, there's a really good reason. That is, I don't know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. But she said, I've never heard a professor at Luther Seminary say, I don't know.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Now think about the fear that we have of imposter syndrome as faculty, where we think we have to BS an answer, right? Mm-hmm. So it's great to be in a place in my career where I can go, I have no idea how I would teach that course, but we're going to do it. So I'm going to reach out to colleagues and say, I'm teaching this course, so I'm not asking your permission.
That's right. That's an important distinction, right? I'm not asking your permission.
I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. What could we read? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And what are some assignments? Mm-hmm. Because if I were to do that otherwise, they'd go, well, you should, no, you have to get that approved. And it's independent study. I don't need to, you know, I don't have.
Well, and maybe what do we read are the blogs, and maybe what do we read turns into what do we watch and what do we listen to and what. Where do we go and who do we interview when text becomes more embodied rather than ancient?
Yeah.
Right. So all those other kinds of things then immediately come into play about course design when you're thinking about the request of the student.
Yeah. That's really good. By the way, you just helped me think of something, but I don't want to lose the point of me being able to say to my colleagues, I don't know how to do this. Mm-hmm. Can you help me? Mm-hmm. People have been in isolation before, right? And you can see, we can think about Paul's letters from prison and then Martin Luther King Jr. and Dietrich Bonhoeffer's letters from prison, right? And other isolating situations, Anne Frank, right? I mean, there's some theological resources that we can think about together. So you just helped me do that. Thank you.
What we're here for, Ralph. Ralph Jacobson, I thank you. A powerful conversation for our listeners as well as for me. I enjoy the conversation with you, Ralph, always. And we're out. How is that, Paul?